Great week.
This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts. Parts of the shot-down suspected Chinese spy balloon appear to be in the hands of U.S. officials. A fisherman in the U.S. state of North Carolina said he saw U.S. Navy personnel arriving at a boat landing in the city of North Myrtle Beach with what appeared to be a white deflated balloon across the bows of two different boats. A Pentagon spokesperson asked about the footage declined to comment on Sunday. U.S. senators will receive a classified briefing on February 15th about that balloon. According to Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, the briefing will also include information on how the U.S. stacks up against China militarily.
Credo che è per l'India il prossimo anno, credo.
Pope Francis said Sunday he's planning to visit India next year and is studying a possible trip that would be a first. During his flight back to Rome from South Sudan, the Pope confirmed that he would be in Lisbon, Portugal for World Youth Day the first week of August. He said he would participate in a September meeting of Mediterranean bishops in Marseille, France. The Pope added there was the possibility that he would fly from Marseille to Mongolia, which would be a first for a pope. Pope Francis, along with the head of the Anglican Communion and the top Presbyterian minister, have together denounced the criminalization of gay people and said they should be welcomed by their churches. The three Christian leaders spoke out on LGBTQ rights during an unprecedented joint airborne news conference returning home from the South Sudan. The South Sudan is one of 67 countries that criminalizes homosexuality. For more on these and other stories, visit us at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Nigerian authorities say they've taken steps to beef up security countrywide following a spike in political violence, banditry, and kidnapping ahead of the February 25th presidential election. VOA reporter Munachi Chucks shares the feeling of residents with this new security posture.
Yeah, there's apprehension in this city. People are worried, even though President Muhammadu Buhari have promised that everything will go right, that the security situation will be taken care of, and the elections, of course, will be free and fair. But yet, citizens are worried.
And that's reporter Munachi Chuck speaking with Chinedu Afor from the Nigerian capital of Abuja. Britain faces its largest ever strike by health workers on Monday as tens of thousands of nurses and ambulance workers walk out in an escalating pay dispute with the government, spelling further disruption for an already strained health system. Nurses and ambulance workers have been striking separately on and off since late last year, but Monday's walkout involving both will represent the biggest in the 75-year history of the National Health Service. The forest fires that have raged in southern Chile since Thursday have caused the deaths of 24 people and the destruction of 800 homes, officials said on Sunday, as international aid begins to arrive in the country. Argentina committed itself to sending brigade members, while the Spanish government announced the departure of an Air Force plane with military personnel and state-of-the-art equipment. Pakistan's former president, Pervez Musharraf, died on Sunday following a prolonged illness at a hospital in Dubai after years in self-imposed exile. Rachel Faber of Reuters produced this spot.
Pervez Musharraf, who ruled Pakistan for nearly a decade during the critical years of the American war against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, died in a hospital in Dubai on Sunday. Musharraf, a former general who seized power in a bloodless coup in 1999, appeared alongside American President George W. Bush less than a month after Al-Qaeda terrorists used jetliners to attack New York City and Washington, and pledged himself as part of a coalition to defeat the militant Islamists and the Afghan Taliban sheltering them. His family said Musharraf was suffering from a rare organ disease called amyloidosis and was admitted to the hospital last year after he became critically ill.
That's Rachel Faber of Reuters. And American actress Viola Davis has achieved EGOT status. That is a person who has won an Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony Award during their career. Davis won a Grammy Award Sunday night. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts, VOA News.
Today is Monday, February 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afua in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Ukraine prepares for a major Russian offensive as activists fight Kremlin disinformation.
In the epic battle against Russian disinformation, it seems only fitting that the citizens taking on Kremlin-backed roles call themselves elves. Thousands of people in Lithuania and the other Baltic states are working to dispel false narratives.
Former Pakistani president who supported the U.S. war against the Taliban dies.
The reaction has been mixed because he left behind a legacy that many Pakistanis do not want to carry forward or recall.
And international election observers and diplomats return to Nigeria as the government beefs up security for the upcoming polls. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Ukraine's Defense Minister Oleksiy Reznikov said on Sunday that Ukraine expects a possible Russian offensive this month, but Kyiv has the reserves to hold back Moscow's forces, even though the latest Western military supplies will not arrive in time. Russian forces have been making incremental advances in the east as Moscow tries to capture the embattled city of Bakhmut and revive its faltering invasion after a string of battlefield setbacks in the second half of last year. Reznikov said the offensive would likely be launched in the east, where Russia is trying to capture all the heavily industrialized Donbass region, or the south, where it wants to widen its land corridor to the occupied peninsula of Crimea. He estimated that Russia had 12,000 troops in Belarusian military bases, a number that would not be enough to launch a significant attack from Belarus in Ukraine's north, reopening a new front. Across Lithuania and other Baltic countries, thousands of activists are fighting Russian disinformation on social media. They call themselves elves, because elves fight trolls. Oleksiy Kovalenko has the story for VOA.
In the epic battle against Russian disinformation, it seems only fitting that the citizens taking on Kremlin-backed trolls call themselves elves. Thousands of people in Lithuania and the other Baltic states are working to dispel false narratives online, often working anonymously. The founder of this unique civic movement is Ričardas Savukynas.
People started calling trolls Russian propaganda. So who fights against Russian propaganda? Of course, elves. So this name started to be used, elves.
The group became especially active after 2014 and the revolution in Ukraine, when protesters demanded the country move closer to the European Union. But to this day, most of the organization members don't know each other. But the ELS movement is not just focused on Ukraine. Viktor Denisenko, a Vilnius University professor and expert on Russian propaganda, says the Kremlin is also trying to affect the Baltic countries' media landscape.
From quite small group of 10 or 20 people, it grow to even not only Lithuanian movement, because I know that today elves also exist in Latvia, in Estonia, in Finland, I think so, and other countries.
Lithuanian parliament member Jurgita Sianina started working with the elves during the COVID-19 pandemic. The elves identify misinformation or fake accounts they can link to Russian troll farms. The elves then band together online and must report the sites until moderators report and remove the fake news. A medical professional by training, Sianina started countering COVID-related propaganda, mostly around vaccinations. But after Russia invaded Ukraine, her focus changed. She commonly takes on false narratives.
Nazism in Ukraine, Russia is freeing Ukraine, I mean all those war issues and topics and also human rights.
Savukynas says Russian disinformation in Lithuania ramped up in the second half of 2021 and was probably linked to Russia's preparations to invade Ukraine. He says that today he finds fewer and fewer so-called vatniks, people who believe the Kremlin's disinformation.
When you see real things, what is going on in Ukraine, those killings, those mass killings, rapings, torturing of children, like in Bucha, you understand that Russian propaganda is simple kind of lies.
As the Russian invasion of Ukraine enters its second year, experts estimate as many as 22,000 activists as a part of ELS movement. Oleksiy Kovalenko for VOA News, Washington.
Western naval forces are having to adapt to a new threat as adversaries develop new capabilities to target critical undersea infrastructure such as gas pipelines and cables. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Huge volumes of natural gas bubbled up through the Baltic Sea as the Nord Stream pipelines linking Russia and Germany ruptured in September. Underwater video shows at least 50 meters of pipeline destroyed, with huge tears observed along the seabed. Swedish investigators found traces of explosives, and the West suspects Russia of sabotage. Days after the incident, Britain announced plans to enhance its undersea defense capabilities. The first of those vessels is currently being fitted out by the British Navy, which says it will act as a mothership, operating remote and autonomous systems for underwater surveillance and seabed warfare. Millions of kilometers of undersea cables and pipelines carry the energy and data that power the global economy. Russia denies sabotaging the Nord Stream pipelines, but observers say the Kremlin increasingly sees Western subsea infrastructure as a vulnerability. In late December, Russia launched four new warships, including two nuclear-powered submarines. Faced with that threat, NATO and the European Union last month launched a joint task force on protecting critical infrastructure. NATO's Secretary General outlined the alliance's posture in October following the Nord Stream explosion.
Any deliberate attack against allies' critical infrastructure would be met with a united and determined response. Hybrid and cyber attacks can trigger Article 5. Can constitute an armed attack against a NATO ally.
The West must clarify its rules of engagement, says analyst Kaushal.
What does one actually do when one observes, for example, a submarine tampering with critical national infrastructure, but not in a way that necessarily leads to an immediate loss of life? So actually, it's more a question of how you change organizational practices to deal with this sort of activity.
Analysts say naval forces must adapt quickly to defend critical infrastructure beneath the waves as adversaries develop new offensive capabilities in hybrid warfare. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Thank you, Henry. As Pakistan is mourned, former President Pervez Musharraf, who died at the age of 79, speculation is growing on whether the government will grant him a state funeral. The former military strongman who ruled the country from 1999 to 2008 lived in self-imposed exile in Dubai to avoid criminal charges stemming from a treason trial. Musharraf, a former Special Forces commander, became president through the last of a string of military coups that roiled Pakistan since its founding amid the bloody 1947 partition of India. For more on the legacy of Musharraf, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Gal.
The reaction has been mixed because he left behind a legacy that many Pakistanis do not want to carry forward or recall as the country moves forward. But we see that the military establishment and government circles and pro-military politicians are all obviously expressing their condolences and recalling his achievements. But the general population, and if you look at the reaction at especially social media, because the mainstream media, television stations in Pakistan are largely influenced by the government, so they are not reporting what the social media and analysts on social media are highlighting. Under Musharraf's leadership, Pakistan joined the U.S.-led war on terrorism in Afghanistan. So as a reaction, this militancy started in Pakistan back then, like 20 years ago, and that militancy continues to create problems for the country and many Pakistanis, and we see regular suicide bomb attacks, and everybody today on social media, mostly the people who are not associated with the government or with the establishment, are blaming the late military leader Pervez Musharraf for creating the situation, which is really becoming a serious challenge for the country.
Some analysts are saying that former President Musharraf's administration was a child of circumstance, that at that point in time, Pakistan was almost at war with itself, that his administration, to a large extent, held the country together during very difficult circumstances.
There is no doubt that when deceased Musharraf seized power in 1999 through a bloodless military coup, Pakistan was facing serious economic challenges and political challenges. And with him coming into power, although it was unconstitutional and he dismissed an elected government, but over the next 2 years, he introduced very effective policies of countering corruption and improving economic situation of the country, and that won him a lot of praise within the country. I mean, it was very unusual for most of Pakistanis that they knew that his acts of seizing power was totally unconstitutional and not legal, but still he was able to garner public support for his actions going after corrupt politicians. And so, yes, there was that time during initial 2 years when he was able to stabilize the country politically and economically. And that's why he was able to take this decision after 9/11 attacks on the United States, when the U.S. approached Musharraf for support. Like, Pakistan shares a long border with Afghanistan, so Pakistan's support was crucial for the U.S. to launch strikes in Afghanistan or a military invasion of Afghanistan through the Pakistani land and air routes.
That's VOA's Ayaz Gao speaking with me from Islamabad. In other news, dozens of Iraqi residents and activists are protesting in the city of Diwaniya days after a 22-year-old YouTube star was killed, allegedly by her father. Interior Ministry spokesperson Saad Mann announced that Taib Ali was killed by her father on January 31st, who then turned himself into the police. Reports said the father strangled Ali at night while she was asleep. The so-called, quote, honor killing, unquote, was met with condemnation from women rights organizations and residents who on Sunday sounded the alarm on violence against women in Iraq and the need to reform legislation to protect women. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Nigerian authorities say they have taken steps to beef up security countrywide following a spike in political violence, banditry and kidnapping ahead of February 25th presidential election. The efforts might be paying off as some diplomats who left the country because of security threats have returned. International political monitors and observers have also arrived in the capital city of Abuja. For more, I spoke with reporter Munachi Chooks.
Capital city. That movement by foreign diplomats really heightens the fears of most Nigerians. They are coming back to the capital city. I must tell you that even foreign observers are already here for the election. One can see the branded European Union vehicles around major hotels in Abuja. Presently, security personnel are seen conducting thorough search of all vehicles plying the streets of Abuja. So no exception to the search.
As the Nigerian government moves to reassure both international visitors and election observers and the residents of Abuja, what is the feeling of residents with this new security posture of the Nigerian government?
Yeah, there's apprehension in this city. People are worried, even though President Muhammadu Buhari have promised that everything will go right, that the security situation will be taken care of, and the elections, of course, will be free and fair. But yet, citizens are worried because usually there's no week that passes by without you hearing any security situation in this country. So we're hoping that things will normalize and the election will go smoothly. So that I mentioned earlier about the foreign diplomats and all of that are coming into the city. Last month, President Buhari welcomed new foreign diplomats into the country. They received their letters of credence from ambassadors of Switzerland, Sweden, Republic of Ireland, Kingdom of Ireland, and the Republic of Senegal, and of course South Sudan.
How has the current political situation, how has the current security situation affected business in and around Abuja?
Yeah, due to the insecurity that's been in vogue in the city, people are mindful of where they go to. The hotels, restaurants, and all other eateries, they close early, unlike, you know, a few years back when you can spend the whole day, you know, up until morning hours outside your home, maybe in a restaurant, in a hotel. So once you're there, either indoors you're mindful where you're going to, and of course, you're also mindful of how long you stay out wherever you are. So that is also worrisome to Abuja residents and the Nigerians in general. Things have not normalized. We're hoping things get normalized, maybe after election.
That's reporter Munashi Chuk speaking with me from Nigeria's capital city of Abuja. Arab media reports that relations between Iran and Syria have taken a turn for the worse after Tehran stopped providing subsidized petroleum products to Damascus. Repeated Israeli attacks on pro-Iranian militia forces are also leading Tehran and its militia allies to question whether some Syrian military commanders aren't informing Israel about their movements. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
A drone strike in late January on a pro-Iranian militia truck convoy near the Syrian-Iraqi border appears to have made both Iran and Syria nervous about their strategic relations after some reports claim that Syrian sources have been giving Israel information about Iranian weapons shipments inside Syria. London-based Syrian analyst Rami Abdulrahman told Arab media that Iran and its Hezbollah and Iraqi militia allies acted quickly to make changes to the personnel at the Bukamel border post between Syria and Iraq and near pro-Iranian militia positions after the Israeli attack. It was not clear if the changes included Syrian government forces. Abdulrahman argues that Syrians were not involved in giving information to Israel. He says that his information is that there are those working for Israel and Hezbollah is aware of it, but they are Lebanese and Iranians rather than Syrians. The movements of the pro-Iranian forces are being telegraphed to the U.S. and Israel. The fact that some convoys are passing unscathed while others are not, he says, points to information coming from inside Iran about what the convoys are carrying. The Saudi-owned Ashark al-Awsat newspaper claimed in an article last week that relations between Tehran and Damascus are tense due to Iranian concerns that Syrian sources might be providing Israel with information about movements by Iran and its allies inside Syria. Joshua Landis, who heads the Middle East Studies program at the University of Oklahoma, tells VOA that many Syrians, including some in the military, are not pleased about Iran's behavior inside their country, and many are worried about those attacks destroying morale in President Bashar al-Assad's forces. Nevertheless, he thinks that tensions between Tehran and Damascus are unlikely to cause any serious breach between the two allies.
I would hate to exaggerate the tensions, although they're very real tensions, because Iran and Syria are connected at the hip, and so is Hezbollah. And in many ways, Iran has been successful in its last 10 years' effort to consolidate its grip both in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon.
Landis stresses that Iran's decision to stop selling subsidized petroleum to Syria has aggravated an already serious economic crisis inside Syria and is making people extremely unhappy and leaving no foreseeable way to get out of the downward spiral. Tensions have only gotten worse, he argues, as sanctions against both Russia and Iran and military pressure on Iran, with the latest strike on an Iranian convoy near the Bukamel border post, makes it look like things are going to go from bad to worse in Syria and raise tensions in all the relationships. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
This is Science in a Minute.
The ice we normally see and use can be referred to as normal hexagonal crystalline ice. Researchers at University College London and the University of Cambridge say they have discovered a new form of ice they call medium-density amorphous ice. The difference between regular crystalline ice and amorphous ice is in its molecular structure. Molecules of regular ice are arranged in an orderly bonded geometric pattern. Molecular particles of amorphous ice aren't in any specific order or pattern. Scientists say in a press release, this new type of ice looks like a fine white powder and that it resembles liquid water more than any other forms of ice. Amorphous ice, while quite rare on Earth, is the primary form of ice found in space. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Go beyond the daily headlines with VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. Each weekday, join us as we put the latest developments into a global context with stories, interviews, and analysis. Listen online at voanews.com/flashpoint or in your favorite podcast player.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com. And check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Afua in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has announced it will provide an additional $125 million to support Ukraine's energy and electricity grid against Russia's continued attacks on utilities and other critical infrastructure. Since the start of the war, the United States has provided $270 million in assistance to help repair, maintain, and strengthen Ukraine's power sector in the face of continued attacks. Since the beginning of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Russian Federation forces have carried attacks out with cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, and unmanned aerial vehicles provided by Iran. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, called these bombings barbaric.
Russia has been using these Iranian UAVs to strike Ukraine's energy infrastructure, depriving millions of Ukrainian civilians of electricity, heat, and critical services in the middle of winter. People in Ukraine today are suffering and dying as a result of Iran's support.
The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, will utilize the $125 million to procure vital equipment, including additional industrial-scale mobile natural gas turbine generators, high-voltage auto transformers, distribution substation repair equipment, and backup power for Kyiv's water supply and district heating services. USAID has already delivered 1,548 generators across Ukraine, with many more on the way. These generators ensure there is electricity and heating for schools, hospitals, accommodation centers for internally displaced persons, district heating companies, and water systems if and when power is knocked out by Russia's airstrikes. The U.S. has also invested $55 million in Ukraine's heating infrastructure to help Ukrainian people get through winter. This assistance will benefit up to 7 million Ukrainians by supporting repairs and maintenance of pipes and other equipment. The U.S. government remains committed to supporting the government and people of Ukraine in responding to the Russian Federation's brutal war against them. The $13 billion in U.S. direct support to the government of Ukraine has helped maintain critical government services. In addition, the U.S. has provided more than $1.9 billion in humanitarian assistance to millions of people, both in Ukraine and in neighboring countries and communities since February 2022. The United States will continue to help those who are suffering, both in Ukraine and outside its borders, and promote accountability for those who violate international law and facilitate this illegal, immoral war.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.